Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, July 31st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at today's weather forecast. This coming from KCRG. We'll wrap up July today with seasonal and sunny weather. Today should look quite similar to yesterday, with highs in the low to middle 80s and a mix of sun and clouds overhead. Humidity remains low again too, but does start to climb a bit ahead of rain increases midweek. August starts off tomorrow in a similar manner. Storm chances are possible late Tuesday into Wednesday and Wednesday night. The bulk of this system misses us to the west and south, so totals in the area will be light. Look for precipitation to be more likely the further south you are. Outside of this, the rest of the week appears dry, with similar seasonal to slightly above average temperatures in the mid to upper 80s. Another rain chance is possible at the end of the upcoming week. And now, the main story on the front page of the Courier, Attorney General still reviewing abortion funding. The decision, when it's made, will be permanent, Brenna Bird says. The story was filed by Aaron Murphy and begins with a photograph of Iowa Attorney General Brenna Bird. Dateline Johnston. A months-long review of state victims' services policies, including the pause in state funding of abortions for rape victims, is ongoing, but a decision is expected soon, a spokeswoman for Iowa Attorney General Brenna Bird said Friday. The policy decisions made as a result of that audit, including whether to permanently stop that state funding for rape victims' abortions, will be permanent and will not require legislative action, Bird said. Bird, on Friday, discussed that ongoing review, her office's pending arguments before the Iowa Supreme Court on the latest legislation to restrict abortions in the state, and other topics during her appearance on this week's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. Bird, in April, paused the Attorney General's office practice of using the state's Victim Compensation Fund to pay for emergency contraception and, in rare cases, abortions for victims of sexual assault, while her office reviewed the policy. Later that month, it was reported that payments for emergency contraception for nearly 70 sexual assault survivors had yet to be reimbursed, according to a statement from Planned Parenthood North Central States, based on records from the Attorney General's office obtained by Iowa Public Radio. The Attorney General's office did not immediately respond to a request for an updated figure on Friday. Quote, "We are working on that audit and what the outcome of that will be. But you're right, we did pause payments to entities like Planned Parenthood and others that were being reimbursed for abortions and for Plan B," Bird said during taping. Quote, "However, those services still remain available under Iowa law to victims. It's just whether public funds will pay for them," unquote. Bird was asked on the program whether, once the audit is done, that policy will become permanent. Bird answered yes, and her office later clarified that she meant whatever decisions were made will become permanent policy, but the specific decisions of whether the state will cover the cost of rape victims' abortions remains undetermined. Bird said the U.S. Supreme Court's 2022 decision to overturn Roe v. Wade paved the way for stronger restrictions on abortions to be considered constitutional by the courts. Bird also declined, as some conservative and Republican Iowans have, to call for impeachment of the three Iowa Supreme Court justices who declined to overrule a 2019 district court judge's decision to block the abortion restrictions passed in 2018. Quote, "My role here is to defend and enforce the law. And here in Iowa, the issue that we have before us is defending the heartbeat law. And I am glad to do that and glad that the Iowa Supreme Court took it up so quickly, so that more innocent lives aren't lost," Bird said. Byrd declined to say what it would take for her to direct her office to prosecute a case that a county attorney declines to prosecute, but did say that such an instance has not yet arisen since she became attorney general after the 2022 elections. Iowa Republicans' sweeping legislation that reorganized the executive branch of state government included language that clarified the attorney general's authority to prosecute any cases, even if a county attorney declines. The attorney general has always had that authority by state law, but the previous attorney general, Democrat Tom Miller, who occupied the office for roughly 4 decades, operated under a de facto policy of not prosecuting local cases unless a county attorney requested his office's assistance. Byrd is a former Guthrie County attorney. Quote, as it stands today, there is no case in Iowa that we have intervened in without the request of the local county attorney, Byrd said. That's not to say it couldn't happen at some point, but it would be an unusual situation. So far, that kind of situation hasn't presented itself. But if it did, and it were necessary, that could be a possibility, unquote. Now we have an article about the Women's World Cup competition in New Zealand, this coming from the Associated Press. Dateline, Dunedin, New Zealand. New Zealand outshot Switzerland and even moved goalkeeper Victoria Essend into an attack position several times, but failed to break a 0-0 tie Sunday in the Women's World Cup and became the first host nation to be eliminated in group play in tournament history. The Football Ferns were co-hosting the World Cup with Australia, which must win Monday against Canada to avoid its own early elimination. Switzerland advanced to the round of 16. The Swiss also played to a scoreless draw against Norway, but won the group with the draw against New Zealand, coupled with the Norwegians' simultaneous 6-0 rout of the Philippines. New Zealand controlled the pace for long stretches of the match and had its chances to score, outshooting Switzerland 12-3. Jackie Hand knocked a shot off the right post in the 24th minute. All 25,947 seats at the Forsyth Barr Stadiums were filled, the only one of Dunedin's 6 tournament matches to sell out. The raucous crowd stomped and cheered all night, to no avail. Norway 6, Philippines 0. Sophie Homenhaug's hat-trick kick started Norway's dominant offense and sparked a blowout of the Philippines in Auckland, New Zealand, that moved the Norwegians into the knockout stage. The Philippines' debut run in the tournament came to an end as Norway scored early and often, netting 3 goals in the first 31 minutes. Norway's spot in the round of 16 was secured when Switzerland and New Zealand simultaneously played to a 0-0 draw. Norway and New Zealand were tied in Group A, but Norway advanced on goal differential. Before the game, Norway had not scored in 3 consecutive Women's World Cup matches dating to the quarterfinals of the 2019 tournament. Colombia 2, Germany 1. Manuela Venegas scored in the 7th minute of stoppage time as Colombia upset Germany in Sydney. The defender headed in to settle a thrilling game and put her country on the brink of advancing to the knockout stage. Alexander Popp had scored an 89th minute penalty and seemed to have earned Germany a 1-1 draw after 18-year-old Linda Casado had struck a stunning opener for Colombia. Morocco 1, South Korea 0. Morocco scored the Atlas Lionesses' first World Cup goal in the 6th minute, and they made it stand up for the remainder of the match. After a lopsided 6-0 loss against Germany, the victory keeps 72-ranked Morocco in contention to advance to the knockout stage of the tournament. Next, Iowa Republicans' still split over presidential hopefuls. Story submitted by Aaron Murphy and Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. The weather and the Republican presidential primary in Iowa are heating up. On a day when the heat index throughout Iowa scorched into the triple digits, 13 presidential candidates addressed a gathering of Iowa Republicans, albeit indoors, under the refuge of air conditioning, at the state's party annual summer fundraiser, the Lincoln Dinner. More than 1,200 people paid at least $150 for a ticket and showed up to hear the candidates speak at the Iowa Events Center in downtown Des Moines, according to a state party spokesman. Conversations with some of those Iowans who attended showed that the primary is far from a settled matter, even though former President Donald Trump has dominated early polling on the campaign. Trump has a 34-point lead over his nearest competitor, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. In Real Clear Politics, rolling average of national polling on the Republican presidential primary. There has not yet been a substantive polling on the contest in Iowa, but what little polling has been published also shows Trump with a large lead over the field here. The Republican Iowa caucuses, the first casting of presidential preference in the nation, is scheduled for January 15th. Republican Party of Iowa State Chair Jeff Kaufman implored the gathering of Iowa Republicans to support the party's eventual nominee in the general election against Democrat incumbent President Joe Biden. Quote, "Yes, there's going to be some elbows by the candidates during the primary. Yes, this is a full contact sport," Kaufman said Friday. Quote, "But we are going to unify and get rid of that fool in the White House," unquote. Brad and Natalie Peterson of Kellerton said before Friday night's candidate speeches, they were interested in hearing from South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott. The husband and wife, wearing Trump Country stickers handed out by the campaign, said they support Trump but are open to another candidate. They said they like Scott's personality and life story. Quote, "I think he's a true American story. I think he's the type of person who's going to try to bring people together," Natalie Peterson said. Quote, "I think we hear that a lot, and there's something about him, just with the events we've seen him speak at. But I would just want to see him in person," unquote. Scott often emphasizes his personal story and family history in campaign ads and speeches. He was raised by a single mother and says his grandfather left school at an early age to work on a cotton farm in the Deep South. The Petersons said they are wavering on Trump in part because of instances where he goes rogue and makes inflammatory statements. Quote, "I still think he can run the country really good. I think he can get us out of a hole we're in," Brad Peterson said. "But sometimes some of the stuff he says just kind of gets me," unquote. Dave Walford of Grinnell expressed a similar concern. Walford said he likes Trump and appreciates what Trump did during his first term, but he is concerned that Trump would lose the general election to Biden, as he did in 2020. Walford said he also likes Scott, Ohio entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. Quote, "I do not have a favorite, but there are some people I do like. My main objective is getting someone that can be elected," Walford said. Quote, "I appreciate what Trump did for the country the first time. My concern is how many people are going to vote against him because they don't like him or don't like what he says," unquote. That, on the other hand, does not concern Roger Rinderknecht of Clive. Roger would prefer that Trump is the candidate, although he also likes and would feel comfortable supporting DeSantis. He said Trump's sometimes abrasive style does not concern him. Quote, "I know Trump says some bad things. He talks bad. He runs people down. He does all the bad things that a guy shouldn't do. But he's still the best candidate," Rinderknecht said. Democrats charge Republicans have far-right agenda. Democrats at a news conference earlier Friday slammed what they called the far-right agenda of the Republican presidential candidates. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz joined Iowa Democratic leaders and said Democrats offer an alternative to the culture war issues in the Republican Party. During this year's legislative session, Minnesota's Democrat Farmer Labor Party took control of the State House and Senate and passed laws strengthening abortion rights, providing universal free school lunch, and paid family leave. Quote, while they're going to go over there and debate tonight what books to ban, we're banning hunger in our schools with the help of the Biden-Harris administration. We're building out for the future, Walz said. Quote, these are the things that make a difference, unquote. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said the policies espoused by Trump's Republican competitors are no different from his MAGA agenda. Quote, tonight, we're going to see desperate candidates peddle divisive rhetoric and extreme policies to pull Americans apart and to win over the fringes of their base, Hart said. Quote, Donald Trump, the undisputed leader of the party, is running again, promising to expand his failed agenda, unquote. Next, we have 5 Iowa nursing homes added to the list of the nation's worst care facilities. This was written by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. 5 Iowa nursing homes have been added to a federal list of the nation's worst care facilities. One of the 5 is a Sioux City home that, after being cited for violations tied to 4 resident deaths, is now in the process of voluntarily closing. The 5 homes are all deemed eligible for inclusion on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services national list of special focus facilities. They join 5 other Iowa care facilities already deemed eligible for inclusion on the periodic list of nursing homes that have recurring quality of care problems. The 5 Iowan homes that have been added to the list since April are Embassy Rehab and Care Center of Sergeant Bluff, Aspire of Gowrie, Countryside Health Care Center of Sioux City, Dunlop Specialty Care Center, and Iowa City Rehab and Health Care. They join 5 other Iowa facilities long considered eligible for special focus status, and they are as follows. Cedar Falls Health Care Center, which has been on the eligibility list for 5 months, Genesis Senior Living of Des Moines, which has spent 14 months on the list, Griswold Rehabilitation and Health Care Center, which has spent 10 months on the list, New London Specialty Care, which has spent 7 months on the list, and Northern Mahaska Specialty Care of Oskaloosa, which has spent 10 months on the list. Iowa has 2 other care facilities that are officially designated as special focus facilities and are operating under additional scrutiny from regulators. Those are Arbor Court of Mount Pleasant and Aspire of Primgar. The 5 Iowa homes recently deemed eligible for inclusion on the list have a history of regulatory issues. Next, Cedar Valley Heart Walk planned for August 19th to celebrate survivors and raise funds. This story written by Courier staff. Dateline Cedar Falls. The American Heart Association's 2023 Cedar Valley Heart Walk will be held August 19th at the Mud Advertising Prairie Lakes campus in Cedar Falls. The association's event to boost physical and mental health allows supporters to celebrate heart attack and stroke survivors, raise life-saving funds, and encourage physical activity. This year's theme is I Walk to Save Lives. Quote, heart disease and stroke impact people in very personal, life-changing ways. Sydney Rogers, the development director for the Cedar Valley Heart Walk, said in a news release, quote, the Heart Walk encourages participants to express, share, and be inspired by the reasons why they walk while supporting an organization that leads the way in the fight against cardiovascular disease, unquote. Congenital heart defect survivor Kemper Kliss serves as this year's ambassador, a six-year-old from Lawler. Kemper was diagnosed with tricuspid atresia with a ventricular septal defect and atrial septal defect. Her condition has required 2 open-heart surgeries. She is active in gymnastics, swimming, and dancing. She loves riding her bike, playing outside with her friends, and rooting for her favorite team, the Iowa State Cyclones. Quote, through this entire experience, Kemper continues to display amazing strength and perseverance. Kemper's mother, Emily Kliss, said in the release, quote, she's received great care from the minute she was born. We look forward to sharing our story at the Heart Walk because we want to help raise awareness and funds so even more lives can be saved, unquote. To register, go online to cedarvalleyheartwalk.org. The walk is sponsored by Mercy One Northeast Iowa and Cedar Valley Medical Specialists. Other key sponsors include Unity Point Health Waterloo, Shields, People's Community Health Clinic, Camping World, and Terex. Next, former Wold tenant in Davenport finds her furniture for sale online. Alicia McGowan thought she'd moved into a dream apartment. In April, the single mother of 2 boys moved the family from the American Park Apartments to the brick building at 309 North Harrison Street, known as The Berg. Quote, it had more space for the boys, space for their bunk bed, and it had a washer and dryer right there in the apartment, McGowan said of The Berg. Quote, I had a lot of high hopes, you know. That's all over now. It's been a nightmare, unquote. The city of Davenport condemned her apartment and ordered her to vacate it on July 5th. McGowan and her 2 sons are without a home and had to leave belongings behind. Other tenants have remained in the building since McGowan's apartment was condemned. The Berg is managed by the Andrew Wold-owned Village Property Management. It was built in 1874 by Henry Berg, a gunsmith. It was purchased by Andrew Wold Investments from Phoenix Properties in 2019. McGowan has been staying on friends' couches or in her car. Her sons are with friends who can house them on a more permanent basis. She said the trouble started with a leak in her laundry room. Quote, the water was falling on the electrical outlet and, eventually, part of the ceiling fell in, she said. And there was black mold that made me sick. I don't know what to do or who I can go to, McGowan said. I'm trying to get a lawyer, but I need a place to live, and I have nothing. I paid $900 a month, and I put down a security deposit. I can't even get the property management people to return my calls. Multiple attempts were made to reach Village Property Management, which no longer lists a working telephone number. McGowan works in Eldridge and has a rental history. But getting a new apartment is, for now, out of her reach. She wasn't prepared to start over so soon after saving up to move to The Berg. She was dealt another blow over the weekend when she discovered furniture from her apartment was up for sale on a Facebook Marketplace page. That posting vanished after McGowan contacted the seller, who did not reply. Quote, my son's bunk bed and my TV stand were being sold, she said. It just made me sick inside. I kept thinking about how sad my kids are going to be when I have to tell them. Quote, mostly, I'm just depressed, and I know my sons are angry. I was the one who complained, and I feel like I'm the one being punished. I thought I was moving to a nicer place. Now we have no place and no one, unquote. Next, firefighters, volunteerism, focus of new John Deere Jessup Fire Department movie. This filed by Andy Malone. Dateline Jessup. In collaboration with John Deere, the Jessup Volunteer Fire Department will screen a new film meant to spur interest in volunteerism and share more about what first responders do on a day-to-day basis. The showing of Odd Hours, No Pay, Cool Hat will be 7 to 8:30 p.m. Sunday at the Fire Department Building, 641 7th Street. The event will begin and end with Firehouse Tours from 6 to 6:40 p.m. and 8:30 to 9 o'clock p.m. respectively. Opening remarks are slated for 6:40 to 7 o'clock p.m. The film is available to anyone and was distributed nationally as part of the National Volunteer Fire Council's Make Me a Firefighter campaign to attract volunteers. Quote, "A big thing with being a volunteer firefighter is community awareness, showing the community what you do, the type of training you go through, and why, when you do fundraisers for training and equipment, why you want so much involvement from the community," said Captain Sean Even, a dangerous goods specialist at John Deere Waterloo Works. The film shines a light on the importance of volunteers who put their lives on the line and respond at all hours of the day. It weaves together diverse stories from around America to paint a portrait of volunteers serving their communities while transforming their own lives in the process. Quote, "Even though it is a small community, a lot of people in the community don't even know we need any help," said Even. Quote, "We need to make people aware that there is definitely a need for volunteers," unquote. Jessup has 28 volunteers with 4 or 5 open slots. According to Even, that's not considered a deficit because many members live or work in Jessup and can respond at any time. John Deere, in a statement, said it recognizes the huge importance of volunteer firefighters and emergency responders in communities across the country and the importance of supporting them. In 2022, Deere employees recorded more than 13,000 hours as volunteer firefighters and emergency responders, more than any other cause, earning nearly $225,000 in rewards from the John Deere Foundation. Quote, "A lot of the communities in the surrounding areas more than likely have community members or volunteer fire department members who work at John Deere. And John Deere has a really cool opportunity called Power for Good," said Jordan Hoffman, one of Jessup's firefighters and also a senior ergonomic professional at John Deere Waterworks. Quote, "The program allows people to donate their time, and with every hour volunteered, Deere puts $20 toward whatever organization you want to donate to." Quote, "The Jessup Fire Department can donate to the department through our volunteerism. We have 5 volunteer firefighters who work at Deere, and a couple people who recently retired from the department but still work at Deere. With a max yearly contribution of $3,500, that can make a huge difference," unquote. And now, in a related story, Cedar Falls kitchen fire Thursday evening displaces residents. Dateline Cedar Falls. A kitchen fire caused significant damage Thursday to a mobile home, displacing the residents who lived there, according to Fire Chief John Zolendek. Firefighters responded at 6:01 p.m. to 9903 Opal Lane in the Five Seasons Mobile Home Park and limited the smoke, fire, and water damage by extinguishing the flames that started on the stove and penetrated the roof at the back of the home. All people and pets were reportedly outside the home by the time Cedar Falls Fire Rescue arrived. Zolendek said a family is believed to have lived there, but exactly how many people is not immediately known. The home is not believed to be a total loss. The cause is still under investigation. Cedar Falls Public Safety was assisted by the Black Hawk County Dispatch Center, Mercy One Paramedics, and Cedar Falls Utilities. And now, listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, July 31st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. If you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, help is available. Call or text 988. Just those 3 numbers, 988. Help is there 24/7, including help with LGBTQIA+ issues. Now let's turn to the opinion section of our program. Our first editorial comes by way of the New York Times, authored by Oliver Berkman. Today's superpower is doing one thing at a time. A few months ago, I was teetering on the brink of feeling overwhelmed by life's responsibilities, afflicted by the ambient anxiety that seems to be an intrinsic part of life in the 2020s. In an effort to maintain, or maybe restore, my sanity, I embarked on a personal endurance challenge. Other people, at similar moments, begin competing in grueling triathlons or head off on intensive meditation retreats. Me? I decided to give up listening to podcasts or music while running or driving or loading the dishwasher or doing almost anything else, to just focus, in other words, on what it was I was actually doing, one activity at a time. It was surprisingly hard. Once you finished mocking me for treating such a trifling alteration to my habits like a grand existential struggle, I have one request. Try it. Identify the small tricks you use to avoid being fully present with whatever you're doing, and put them aside for a week or two. You may discover, as I did, that you were unwittingly addicted to not doing one thing at a time. You might even come to agree with me that restoring our capacity to live sequentially, that is, focusing on one thing after another in turn, and enduring the confrontation with our human limitations that this inherently entails, may be among the most crucial skills for thriving in uncertain, crisis-prone future we all face. It's not that the urge to multitask is anything new. Quote, "One thinks with a watch in one's hand," Nietzsche complained as early as 1887. Quote, "Even as one eats one's midday meal while reading the latest news of the stock market." You've also long known that multitasking doesn't really work. You've probably read, perhaps while half-watching TV, articles explaining the research findings that multitasking isn't really even possible. Mainly, we're just switching our attention rapidly between different foci without realizing it, incurring cognitive costs each time we do so. One study of drivers found only 2.5% of people showed no performance decrease when attempting two tasks at once. The rest of us just end up doing everything worse. Yet the pressure to multitask can often seem like something imposed on us from outside. Burdened by so many demands at work, you can feel as though you've no choice but to split your attention among them. Meanwhile, you should feel some responsibility to address the troubles of the wider world as well. Then the causes for alarm. The climate, the fate of the democracy, the threats from artificial intelligence, and the risk of nuclear war, to name just a few, are so numerous as to make multitasking look like every citizen's duty. Technological advances turn the screw further. Those of us not raised as digital natives can remember a time when we didn't have the option of using social media to distract ourselves from unpleasant tasks, and when the limits imposed by our tools, the speed of snail mail, for example, or the time it took to visit a library to conduct research, meant we felt less pressure from bosses or customers to somehow transcend the limits imposed by our finite attention spans. But philosophers and spirit teachers have long understood that the urge to avoid giving ourselves fully to any single activity goes deeper to the core of our struggles as finite human beings. The Hindu mystic Patanjali, for example, saw doing one thing at a time as a core yogic discipline, suggesting that it didn't come easily to people 2,000 years ago either. We rail against what the Christian productivity writer Jordan Rayner calls our unipresence, our inability to be in more than one place at a time, in contrast to the omnipresence attributed to God, and against the shortness of our time on earth, which averages little more than 4,000 weeks. All this finitude feels unpleasantly constraining, because it means there will always be many more things we could do than we ever will do, and that the choice to spend a portion of our time on any one thing automatically entails the sacrifice of countless other things we might have done with it. This explains the attraction of multitasking. It offers the false promise that we might somehow slip the bonds of our finitude. We tell ourselves that with sufficient self-discipline, plus the right time management tricks, we might finally get on top of everything and feel good about ourselves at last. This utopia never arrives, of course, though it often feels as if it might be just around the corner. The uncomfortable truth is that the only way to find sanity in an overwhelming world and to have any concrete effect on that world is to surrender such efforts to escape the human condition and drop back down into the reality of our limitations. Distracting yourself from challenging tasks by, say, listening to podcasts doesn't actually make them more bearable over the long term. Instead, it makes them less enjoyable by reinforcing your belief that they're the sort of activities you can tolerate only by distracting yourself, while at the same time, all but ensuring that you'll neither accomplish the task in question nor digest the contents of the podcast as well as you might otherwise. At work, the way to get more things done is to learn to let most of them wait while you focus on one. Quote, "This is the secret of those people who do so many things and apparently so many different things," unquote, wrote the management guru Peter Drucker in his book, The Effective Executive. They do only one thing at a time. Making a difference in one domain requires giving yourself permission not to care equally about all the others. There will always be too much to do, no matter what you do. But the ironic upside of this seemingly dispiriting fact is that you needn't beat yourself up for failing to do it all, nor keep pressuring yourself to find ways to get on top of it all by means of increasingly extreme multitasking. Instead, you can pour your finite time, energy, and attention into a handful of things that truly count. You'll enjoy things more, into the bargain. My gratifying new ability to be here now while running or driving or cooking dinner isn't the result of having developed any great spiritual prowess. Rather, it's a matter of realizing I could only ever be here now anyway, so I might as well give up the stressful struggle to pretend otherwise. A note to the listener, Oliver Berkman is the author of 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Next, we have an editorial which appeared in the Storm Lake Times Pilot, written by Art Cullen, A War Over Food, Russia's Reprehensible Attacks on Ukraine's Food and Agriculture Systems will backfire as they are sure to create even more misery among the world's poor and hungry. Russia pulled out of an agreement brokered by Turkey through the United Nations to allow grain shipments to sail the Black Sea undisturbed. It followed by bombing grain stocks, the port city of Odessa, and ports along the Danube near Romania. Ukraine is a major grain and oilseed exporter to Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and China. The attacks immediately drove wheat prices up 17%, and other commodities followed. Russia claimed that it would provide grain to nations in need, but markets obviously know better. If Russia thought it could deny Ukraine revenue, it already is a welfare state of NATO. Bordering nations like Romania, whose farmers are getting edgy over Ukraine grain flooding their markets, will steel their resolve to unite against Russia. It's yet another miscalculation by the Kremlin. It will increase commodity prices for the U.S. farmers and will complicate efforts to keep inflation in check. China must be watching this warily. Beset by drought and short wheat yields, it can scarcely afford far higher grain prices. Russian attempts to hurt Ukraine will hurt China, Moscow's main benefactor. This could be what it takes for China to put brakes on Russia's lunacy. The whole episode should remind us how food and agriculture play a critical role in security and geopolitics. We underestimate the issue's importance at our peril. Russia has become a major grain exporter against Ukraine over the past 25 years. One reason for the war is for Russia to consolidate its hold over food exports as its leverage with fossil fuels rapidly declines. The United States should recognize it and be in a position to organize a response that actually fights world hunger. We should be urgently engaging with those affected by Russia's ill-conceived attacks on food. If we were, it likely would bring an end to the war. We continue to pretend that it is about something else as we ship more cluster bombs. It is not about pride or sentimentality or a lost empire. It is about food. They are attacking grain elevators. Can we not see that? Next, we have a piece written by Randy Evans, and it appeared in the Storm Lake Times Pilot newspaper, among others around Iowa. It's his Stray Thoughts column, titled this time, Thin Skin Plagues Some Officials in Iowa. Around the time the famous movie The Bridges of Madison County premiered in 1995, author Robert James Waller was at a book signing in West Des Moines. Between scribbling his signature for fans on copies of his novel, Waller answered questions from a Des Moines Register reporter. At one point, the persnickety Iowan became peeved by the nature of the reporter's questions. He yanked the notebook from her hand and flipped it aside. That led to a letter to the editor a few days later in the Register, in which a reader observed that Waller should use some of his millions in book and movie royalties to buy himself a thicker skin. Some local government officials in Iowa show signs of needing thicker skins, too, because they have tried to silence critics at meetings of city councils and school boards for making comments they did not like. Earlier this month, Davenport Mayor Mike Mattson threatened to adjourn any city council meeting if a member of the public makes comments that he or the city attorney believe are defamatory toward city employees or officials. Controversy has bubbled in Cherokee over plans to arm up to 40 school employees with guns. Last month, the school board president read a statement in which the school's attorney suggested legal action could be taken against a Cherokee mother for calling school officials inept. And in the Bettendorf School District, as in some other Iowa districts, the school board president reads a statement before the public forum portion of each meeting. That statement claims, inaccurately, that Iowa law prohibits discussing specific employees or their job performance. The Cherokee School Board has a similar prohibition on naming individuals, although it cites school policies and Robert's Rules of Order as the legal basis for preventing speakers from mentioning employees by name. Do such policies violate the First Amendment's right to freedom of speech? If people cannot criticize government employees by name during meetings, does that mean that they cannot praise an employee either? It would not be a reasonable viewpoint, neutral position for a city council or school board to take if officials permitted praise but not criticism. These are not hypothetical questions. Noah Peterson can tell you that. The Newton man was arrested at successive meetings of the Newton City Council last October for refusing to comply with the city council policy that bars derogatory statements or comments about any individual. Peterson was charged with disorderly conduct for harshly criticizing Newton police officials and Mayor Michael Hansen. Jasper County Magistrate Peter Lawn found Peterson not guilty. His written verdict should be read by government officials from Ackley to Zwingle, because it contains important reminders about the meaning of the First Amendment. Quote, it would be difficult, if not impossible, for a concerned citizen to comment regarding city policies or the provision of city services without referencing to some extent an official city position, for example, mayor, police chief, etc., the magistrate wrote. Quote, the defendant was not a spectator, but rather a participant in a limited public forum during the recognized citizen participation portion of the city council's meeting. He did not act in any objectively unreasonable manner. He read a prepared statement relating to the basic city service of policing, unquote. Magistrate Lawn continued, quote, "The First Amendment is an integral part of our law and social framework. Speech concerning public affairs is the essence of self-government," unquote. The Newton City Council meetings include a specific time for citizens to share their input on city services and policies, the magistrate said. Peterson remained at the podium and did not use abusive language or gestures when he addressed the council, the magistrate said. Nothing in Peterson's actions substantially impaired the conduct of the council's meetings, the magistrate added. I understand the concerns of government officials in places like Davenport and Cherokee about unnecessary harm to the reputation of government employees, but a bigger concern should be the not-so-subtle form of intimidation these policies represent, especially with the Davenport mayor saying he will immediately adjourn council meetings if a speaker begins making comments that are, quote, defamatory in nature, unquote. Defamation is not a synonym for criticism. Lots of people criticize me or my former employer without crossing the line to defaming me or the Des Moines Register. I knew what I was getting into when my name began appearing on the masthead. Likewise, it should not surprise Davenport City leaders that some people are critical of how city government responded to complaints about conditions at an apartment in the weeks before the back side of the 6-story building collapsed in May, killing 3 people. But just because some people's opinions are critical of city leaders or key city employees does not automatically make those opinions defamatory. When controversy ensues, government officials are short-sighted when they try to take away the ability of people to voice their views of government and its workers. Voters are perceptive. They see these efforts to muffle dissent for what they are, thinly veiled attempts to intimidate people into silence on the matters of tremendous local interest. Being able to receive public criticism is in the job description for elected officials and top-level city administrators. At least it should be. It certainly is for newspaper editors. In a note to listeners, Randy Evans is the executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council and a longtime journalist and editor in Iowa. Now we have an editorial from the Des Moines Register, which appeared on Sunday. The climate crisis is already here. Iowa has to work on adapting. The oppressive heat that has stalked the country this summer finally reached Iowa last week. A few near triple-digit days in our state in July isn't at all out of the ordinary. These developments are a good bit more alarming, however, and that's the following. Atlantic ocean currents that circulate heat around the planet could be slowing in a way not seen in millennia, according to research published Tuesday. It's possible the currents will collapse in the next 75 years, scientists said, and a prolonged heat wave in Florida has contributed to what some scientists suspect are unprecedented water temperatures off the coast, exceeding 100 degrees Fahrenheit in places, according to the Washington Post. And global temperatures have set weekly and monthly record highs, the World Meteorological Organization said this month. Antarctica sea ice has never been lower in June in about 45 years of satellite observations. These aren't predictions. This is what's happening now. A part of the political fight concerning human-caused climate change has always been whether scientists' understanding of what was happening was sufficient to justify the dramatic societal upheavals required to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in a meaningful way. The near consensus among serious climate investigators should leave little doubt, but even those who reject projections from such groups as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the attribution of warming to human activity cannot so easily shrug their shoulders at conditions that are now being observed directly. The record temperatures and other headlines are not merely a projection subject to revision. They are real. Iowa needs a new climate adaptation mindset. How should Iowa react? One way to start would be to start treating climate issues as a matter of stewardship and public health, rather than fixating on economic development considerations. It's been dispiriting but illuminating over the past couple of years to see how nakedly state leaders and the ethanol industry present proposed carbon dioxide pipelines as solely an economic development tool, reflecting what Governor Kim Reynolds called in 2021, quote, the growing nationwide demand for a more carbon-free economy, unquote. Environmental advocates are deeply skeptical that the pipelines can be a net benefit to the state and region, but that leaders don't even pretend to have CO2 emissions motivations for their own sake is disappointing. Government at all levels, businesses of all sorts, and individuals have roles to play in decisions that address carbon dioxide emissions in ways large and small. But just as important is providing more urgent attention to what adaptations to an altered climate might look like. That means what Iowa farmers grow and how. It means assessing flood risk with the expectation that history is not a strong guide for the frequency and severity of what will happen in the future. It means worrying about water use and the prospect for such sources as the Jordan Aquifer. Next, we have families seek answers as man sentenced in 2022 Waterloo double murder. Dateline Waterloo. Family members of Tamika Allison and Andrea Rochelle Anderson want answers as to why the two were gunned down in Allison's home in 2020. The one man who can shed light on that question, 39-year-old Matthew D. Buford III, Allison's boyfriend, remained silent as he received back-to-back life sentences for murder on Thursday. Quote, why did you have to take those two beautiful women out of our lives? They were going to be great mothers, Muhammad Calhoun, Anderson's son, told Buford. Quote, I just want to know why did it happen? Why did it have to be my mom? As the result of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, was it premeditated? Muhammad Calhoun said. Quote, if you had any ounce of human decency left, I would just ask you to let us know why. Unquote. He recounted how only weeks before the slayings, Buford told him not to be afraid of him, that they were family. Buford had said something similar to Fatima Calhoun, Anderson's oldest daughter, who is now raising her youngest siblings in her mother's absence. Quote, what hurts the most is I'm not able to mend their small little broken hearts. My mother was all that we had. I will never understand why you did this, Fatima Calhoun said. Quote, if you have a heart left, it would be nice if one day you could tell us. Until then, I do not forgive you, unquote. Also confronting Buford was Allison's father, Joe Martin. Quote, why would you do this to my daughter and her friend? Martin asked. Quote, you are twice their size. You didn't have to shoot them, unquote. During Buford's trial in June 2023, prosecutors didn't suggest any motive for the killings. Authorities said Buford, Allison, and Anderson had been drinking at the West 2nd Street home Allison and Buford shared for the night of February 10, 2020. Allison's teenage daughter testified she was in her bedroom upstairs when she heard her mother say, quote, what are you going to do, shoot me in the face? I don't care. I'm not scared, unquote. Two gunshots followed, and when the daughter went downstairs, she saw the two bodies on the floor and Buford holding the gun. Buford dropped off the daughter and her younger brother at other homes and then left the state. He turned himself in days later in Peoria, Illinois. The murder weapon was later found in his friend's unlocked garage. Jurors found Buford guilty of two counts of first-degree murder and flight to avoid prosecution. Next, Waterloo police officer bitten by dog while investigating suspicious vehicle. The story was written by Andy Malone. Dateline Waterloo. A police officer was bitten by a dog while investigating a suspicious vehicle Friday night according to Sergeant Jeff Tyler. The officer then shot and killed the dog before being treated about a mile away at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital for the leg injury. Navias Shaker Johnson, 18, was charged with interference with official acts causing bodily injury and was released after paying a $1,300 bond. Police responded to the 9:35 p.m. call for a suspicious white Ford circling the area of Parker and 4th Streets. The officer was pulling up next to the vehicle in the parking lot of the old St. Mary's Catholic Church and school at 2127 East 4th Street when Johnson reportedly got out and took off running toward a home. The officer caught up to Johnson and became involved in a struggle with him. Police say the teenager intentionally opened the door of the home, allowing the dog, believed to be an English bulldog, outside to attack. No other evidence of wrongdoing was found. Johnson reportedly told officers he was running out of fear of the police. He has been the subject of past calls, including March 11th, when Johnson was charged in another incident for harassing officers and interfering with official acts. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, July 31st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier and of the other newspapers around Iowa that we record. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.